And we're back here on Psychedelic Spotlight, part two. With me today, John Gilmore. I'm Ken Allen, and I wanted to drop in here at this time. This program is brought to you on the MAPS website, and if you are so inclined, certainly donations are appreciated. MAPS is a member-supported organization, and you can check their website, which is www.maps.org. There's links there for making a donation and for becoming a member of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. So, John, we were talking about the kids' laptop program. Anything you wanted to add there before we move into? I wanted to ask you about the .alt news group.
Sure. Just that the One Laptop per Child program attracted a lot of criticism in the beginning and managed to persist through it. It hasn't accomplished all of its furthest-flung goals, but one thing it did accomplish was, actually two things it accomplished. First, it made the public and the technical community aware that you really could build a functional, usable laptop for a few hundred bucks. And that was an interesting revelation, because as goods go from being expensive to cheap, the demand for them goes up dramatically. The demand for a plasma TV at $2,000 is much, much, much lower than the demand for a plasma TV at $100. Mm-hmm. And the same is true of this sort of educational aids for kids.
Okay.
That set off the netbook revolution, which is the only category of computers that has been growing in dollar volume and unit shipments in the last few years. I think they shipped 12 million netbooks last year, and they're on track to ship something like 50 million this year. These are $200 or $400 small laptops. That was a direct result of the One Laptop per Child project. The other thing that the project taught the world was that education of children in undeveloped countries in the second, third, fourth, whatever, the non-first world, were a serious market for computers, for technology. That if you brought the right products to them, these education systems had millions of kids to educate and millions of dollars with which to do it, and that you could make money there. So it was a market that had been virtually ignored by the whole worldwide tech community, and now it's being addressed much more actively, with the result that a lot more kids will get a better education, even if they don't get it directly from a Nicholas Negroponte One Laptop per Child.
Well, that's a great program. John, let me ask you now, moving to the back to the internet, the alt hierarchy is something that you worked on creating. Maybe for some of our listeners who don't know a lot about that, first of all, what is a news group, and then what's unique about the alt.  hierarchy news group?
Okay. News group was one of the earlier forms of computer-mediated communication. You see things like it nowadays. They call them forums, where anybody can come in and post a comment, and other people can react to that and post their own comments related to it. These discussions or conversations are organized into topic areas, and so that's the general kind of communication that went on in the news groups. The actual technology by which they were done was they ran on Unix systems, which were fairly large computers, bigger than personal computers at the time. They ran in the 1980s, and 90s on these computers, and gradually the software migrated down into ordinary personal computers. But in those days, we didn't have the internet, so all this communication happened over phone lines, where the computers would pick up the phone with a modem and dial each other and transfer these bits of conversation back and forth every night. Mm. This was called the Usenet, or the Unix Users Network, and it was a powerful tool in my day for learning and having conversations with people all over the world on any topic that I wanted to talk about. Many of them oriented towards computers, because to be on this, you had to be on a fairly expensive machine. So you were probably at a university working in a computer science department, or at a company that worked with computers. So the Usenet was, and one of the interesting aspects of the Usenet was that it had no center. That is to say, it didn't require anyone's permission to join it. It was a distributed system. If you knew somebody whose machine was on the Usenet and they were willing to hook their computer up to yours by having them call each other, then you could be on the Usenet. It was sort of, again, a tie back into this sort of free philosophy of society, to say, rather than have some centralized bureau decide who can do what, who's allowed to be on the net and who's allowed to talk about what, it's widely distributed. If you can find one other person who thinks you should be on the net, then you'll be on the net. Mm-hmm. And that made it a very powerful medium of communication. But it turned out one part of the Usenet was centralized, and that was the list of topic areas that people could talk about, the set of news groups. And that was organized through a group of system administrators, a group of people who worked keeping the computers running, mostly for different companies and universities. Back in those days, long-distance phone calls were expensive, so it was pretty easy to get a link between your computer in San Francisco and, say, another computer in San Francisco or in Oakland or in Palo Alto. You know, it's maybe 20 or 30 miles away. The phone bills wouldn't be too bad, but you didn't want to be calling across the country to New York, or even worse, calling to Europe, say, to transfer this data, because you would run up thousands and thousands of dollars of phone bills. So there was a set of organizations, companies, and universities who actually were making those transfers that tied together the whole world of people who used the Usenet. And they formed a group that sort of self-jokingly called themselves the Backbone Cabal. And their policies on which topic areas they would transfer around the world sort of controlled what you could talk about. Mm-hmm. And mostly they were concerned because, in many cases, these phone calls were hiding in the budgets of huge companies. You know, IBM or Digital Equipment Corporation, General Electric, those sorts of companies, but AT&T, actually, the phone company. You know, nobody actually read the phone bills at AT&T. You know, they just sort of wrote off that amount of traffic. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to make sure that these administrators who were pushing the data over long distances wanted to make sure that no middle manager ever had any reason to come look and say, why are you making all these calls? Why did your computer call out 10,000 times last month? And so they tried to avoid having discussions that would be on risky topics. Mm-hmm. And one of the topics I wanted to talk about was drugs. It seemed to me that the information that was available out in the sort of usual methods of communication, that books and newspapers and magazines and television, wasn't very accurate about drugs, and I thought we ought to use this technology to have a forum where people could really talk about their own real experiences with drugs and educate each other. And so I proposed the creation of a news group called originally net.rec. I think it was ultimately rec.drugs. Rec stood for the recreation area. And there were, you know, recreational sports groups and recreational chess groups and all kinds of things. And I just wanted a group that talked about recreational drugs. And I followed all the right procedures, stuff which I had helped to create, to come to consensus that we ought to have such a topic area. And then the backbone cabal refused to carry it. They were concerned that, you know, some senator would come down and say, why is your computer being used to carry drug discussions? And so what we did was just a little bit of jujitsu. We said, okay, we're going to make a news group that will talk about drugs, but you don't have to carry it. In fact, only the people who want to talk about drugs should carry this news group. And we will provide the backbone that hooks together the different parts of the world that want to be in this discussion. And so my computer in my basement became one of the hubs of this network. And I reached out to people who administered computers in other situations like my own, where I was running the machine myself. I didn't have an administrator looking over my shoulder. I didn't have a boss to report to. And we shouldered the cost ourselves of calling among our computers. But like any other news group, once it got to a certain city, then it could be passed around by people essentially free doing nighttime phone calls in that city. Mm-hmm. So I had links to a little school in Houston, an academy, and I had links to a bulletin board sort of system in New York City and places like that. And whatever discussions about drugs had accumulated in the Bay Area during the day would pile up on my disk, and then at 11 o'clock when the phone rates got cheap, my computer would pick up the phone and dial those guys, transfer that data, and bring back any parts of the conversation that were coming from Houston or New York and keep that network together. Well, that worked, and it used all the same software. It just used a different backbone. And on that basis, it was accepted by the rest of the Usenet community. The interesting thing that happened, I had a couple of co-collaborators in that, Brian Reed and Gordon Moffat. Brian had wanted to start a group about gourmet cooking, and the powers that controlled these things said, no, we're happy with the cooking groups we already have. We don't want your cooking group. So he was also kind of a disgruntled, you know, I want this topic to work the way I want it person, and he helped out with this. And Gordon was another friend who was administering another system and sympathetic. So the interesting thing that happened was we tied this together. My phone bills were running about $600 a month, which I could afford at the time. And it stayed that way for about 6 months. And it built itself up to where maybe a quarter or a fifth of the Usenet was carrying the alt groups. And then, in a stroke of what can only be described in retrospect as genius, Brian Reed started a news group, alt.sex. because sex had been another one of these risque topics that the backbone cabal was unwilling to carry. But unlike drugs, everyone's interested in sex. And within 4 months after he created Alt.Sex, something like 80% of the Usenet was carrying the alt groups. And we made the rules for how to create a group in the alt groups pretty simple. We said, use common sense, right? If there's already a discussion on this topic, use it, right? If there isn't, create one, right? Don't make it too narrow. Don't make it too broad. Just use common sense. Not everyone did, but enough people did that the alt groups were successful, and they brought that philosophy of freedom into a situation that had been technologically constrained to have a a little bit of an oligarchy running it.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about that, because so this system, although it was hierarchical, had no centralized control per se, and maybe just speak a little bit about the presence of the what seems to be the abiding presence of hierarchies in human nature.
Well, I don't know. Hierarchies are sort of good enough if you can't do anything better. You know, it's kind of what people fall back on when they can't think of anything else.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me the traditional way to design a network, which had kind of come up out of IBM, was you make it a hierarchy and you put a big IBM mainframe in the center and you put little smaller machines around the edges, and that was their idea of how to run a network. And it took years of experience with those kind of networks for people to realize that doesn't work for all the things we want it to do. It's got problems.
Mm-hmm.
The people, you know, it means everything has to go through the middle, which is expensive and slow, and tends to restrict what people can do rather than enable what people can do.
Well, how would you compare? Go ahead. How would you compare the idea of the web, like an interconnected web of the internet, which may almost be kind of more anarchical in nature, with a hierarchy?
Well, I was getting to that.
Oh, okay.
The after experiencing some of those centralized networks, people started experimenting with, well, how would you build a network that would still work but wouldn't have the control in the center? Some of this work came out of social efforts, efforts to tie together different local bulletin board systems. Some of this work came out of military research on how you would build a system that could survive a first strike from a nuclear enemy, where you lose half or two-thirds of the nodes in the network because they've been blown up. And so how do you build a network so the remaining nodes are not in total chaos, but they can actually talk to each other? And to do that, you have to eliminate the concept of the center. And that requires different protocols, different ways of agreeing to communicate. I don't think this is the right form to get into the deep technology of that.
Okay.
But the internet, the Usenet was one such network, and the internet was another such network designed by computer science researchers, mostly paid by government military research money. And one of the interesting aspects of these networks is they scale up better than decentralized networks. In fact, they scale down better as well. Right? You can build an internet with two machines. Mm-hmm. Right? That just have a wire between them, have an ethernet between them, and they'll talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You can also build an internet with 10,000 machines. Or, in the case of the world internet, you know, with billions of machines. And one of the hard problems in engineering is scale. Is how do you design something that works in the lab, and when you sell it to 1,000 customers, it still works when they all hook it together, and when you sell it to 1,000,000 customers, it still works when they all hook it together. Mm-hmm. It's hard, and it's taken many years to figure out how to do that. And the key to doing it tends to be not centralizing it. I would be surprised, for example, if something that you think of as centralized, like Google, I suspect is really not centralized at all. I mean, yes, they have a company and they have a headquarters, but they have servers all over the world. And when you type www.google.com into your web browser, it doesn't take you to the same place every time. It takes you to a data center in Washington State or in India or in Asia or somewhere else in the United States. And the technical beauty in that is you don't know the difference. Right? That's sort of the holy grail of distributed system. You can hook into it anywhere and it all looks the same. The internet is designed that way. In particular, the internet routing system is designed that way. The way it gets, when you put a packet into it that's destined for a particular place, the way it gets it there has no center.
I see.
It does have a couple of centers in other areas. Mm-hmm. So the fact that the routing system doesn't have a center meant that anybody could be an internet service provider as long as they could find one other internet service provider that would feed a wire to them.
Okay, and
take central permission from anybody. You didn't have to apply to a government agency. You didn't have to apply to IBM. Nobody could vet you for this. Mm-hmm. If you found one other ISP who would connect to you, you're on the net. And that's why we got thousands of ISPs in the 1990s. And that directly led to the level of freedom we have on the internet today. Because in those days, if you got onto an internet service provider and they didn't like what you were doing, and they said, oh, we don't like you talking about drugs, or we don't like the website you have that's about sex, or we think, you know, you're running a gambling outfit and we don't like people who run gambling outfits,
mm-hmm.
or whatever, or you're publishing these things that might get us in trouble with the government, you know, because you're revealing their illegal wars or whatever, you were free to pick up and move to another ISP and start feeding them your money.
Mm-hmm.
And there were enough of them around that you could usually find one that would carry your traffic. That isn't true anymore. There's been a consolidation. And the consolidation has mostly come out as a result of high-speed internet access mm-hmm. being monopolized by the phone and cable companies. And so now the vast majority of people get their internet access not from a mom-and-pop operation, but from a telco or a cable company. And those guys have every incentive to squeeze you. They're children of government regulation. They grew up in an era of government regulation. They're very used to it, and they're very used to manipulating it.
Mm-hmm.
And what they are trying to do is structure the internet such that you don't have a choice. Right? You have a choice between Tweedledum and Tweedledee, and both of them will arrange to have equally bad terms so that if you don't like how they're treating you, you can't just pick up and move on and feed your money to somebody else.
So they're
because the internet didn't start that way, people still have an expectation that they have freedom on it. And that's half the battle. If you're just willing to stand up to your IST and say, no, I'm not going to follow your rules. If you don't like it, kick me off. I'll go elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Just having the spunk to say that is enough to handle 90% of the problem.
Now, that's interesting. How does that play into the idea, and this will probably be, we have to wrap up here after this, but the idea of the world's operating without scarcity, finding a peaceful path to an era of plenty, as you've said.
Well, there's part of the technological trends that we've been talking about here. Both the across the 200 years, 1800 to 2000, and also the last 50 years, are part of a trend in general where the population has been rising. We've been able to specialize more in general. We have a lot more minds looking at the same old problems and coming up with new ways to solve them. We've seen this kind of rapid progress in several domains that give us more control over the physical world and more control over our own level of resources. And some people have extrapolated those trends forward to say, we may be entering an era where there's an end to scarcity, where already, for most people in the United States, they don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from. Even if they're unemployed, right, they have resources. There's so much spare food in this society that it takes real work to go hungry. There's so much spare food in this world that it takes... usually the reason we have people starving is because transportation and logistics have broken down in an area, typically because some people are fighting a war there. But food is not the only thing we need. There's, shelter and love and information, all these other things. The energy. The level of detailed control over matter that we have gained brings lots of opportunity to manage the resources that we have in the same way that computers are built fundamentally out of sand and metal, right? It's silicon and wires. And we had sand and metal for a long time before we figured out that they were useful for communicating podcasts around the world. Similarly, there's a lot of other resources we have that we haven't yet figured out how to deploy them to satisfy human wants and human needs, but we're getting really good at it. And so the theory is if we actually get to an era in which ordinary physical objects are not scarce, in which energy is not scarce, how do we transition from the society we have today to that one? It's not a simple thing. People depend on their jobs, and many of their jobs involve making physical things and selling them to other people. We have a social structure that's built around scarcity and an economic structure that's built around scarcity. And one of the scarier aspects of the technological change we're facing is that those social and economic systems will not be up to the challenge of dealing with a post-scarcity world, and that will result in widespread social and economic dislocations, which, of course, is the last thing you want when you're, when you finally succeeded at the age-old quest to feed and clothe and house everybody. And then society breaks down because people can't agree on how to do it.
Right.
So my last company was a free software company. We created software, we gave it away, and then we encouraged people to pay us. And you think, well, how would that work? Indeed, most people thought it was a total crazy idea. But what we had discovered was that giving away the software showed people what it was good for, but it didn't do 100% of what they wanted it to do. And we targeted medium-sized businesses who were already using the software, but they needed help with it. Maybe they were a networking company. You know, and their job is to build something that puts people on the network and keeps the network running. They don't really have any experts there at programming tools, which is what our free software did, but they need to use them to build their network business, to build their equipment. So they were already using our tool because they downloaded it off the net and it was free, but they might have a few problems with it, or they might have a few opportunities that they couldn't follow up because it didn't do the things they could imagine it doing. And so we would call them up and say, well, we're the guys who wrote those tools. We would be happy to solve your problem for you if you pay us money. It's totally free transaction. We're not coercing you, you know. You're totally free to use the software if you don't ever pay us any money. Mm-hmm. But if you see a business opportunity and you think that us changing the software would let you follow up on that opportunity, give us a call. Mm-hmm. And we found lots of companies who we could enable that way. And ultimately, we grew the business from three guys in an apartment to 150 people spread across in offices all over the continent and a few in Europe, and then sold the company off for $600 million.
And that was Cygnus.
To a larger company that has similar philosophy called Red Hat. Mm-hmm. And anyway, that was an experiment in a post-scarcity business to say, okay, we figured out in software that the cost to make a new copy of software is nil, right? Anyone with a computer can do it, can take the software that's already on it, copy it onto another computer, copy it onto a CD, onto a hard drive, onto a flash drive. It costs them nothing, it takes 2 minutes. So what kind of economic and social structure can we build in such a world? And we built an economic structure that let people have all that freedom and still had money flow from people whose problems got solved towards the people who were helping them solve those problems. Mm-hmm. And that showed me, and showed a lot of other people, that you could do this in a post-scarcity world. That if everybody didn't have to buy a bed because, you know, you had a little machine in the corner that would print out a bed if you needed one, well, all those people who make beds, you know, they're not going to be able to get hundreds of dollars per bed from you anymore because you can just print one out for $10. But not everybody wants the same bed, and so there'll always be room for people to spend a little more money to solve your problem. Oh, you have a problem with your circulation, your bed needs to do this. Oh, you have this other problem, you have to fit this space, etc. Mm-hmm. And so there's an opportunity to solve people's individual problems and be paid for it.
John, it's been a fascinating conversation. We're about out of time. Do you have any just closing thoughts you'd like to share with our web listeners?
Well, I want to thank everyone who has supported MAPS, and particularly anyone who's made it all the way to the end of this podcast. We couldn't do the research that we're doing. We couldn't do the educational work and the social work and the governmental work know, scientific work without your support. And you are a big part of making it happen, because besides having a mission of learning scientific knowledge and reforming government rules, one of the biggest challenges we face around the use of psychedelics in society is educational. And you who are listening are our troops on the ground, educating the people who you know about to not be afraid of psychedelics, to understand these are powerful tools. I mean, electricity is a powerful tool, and you don't stick a fork into the wall socket because I've heard what happens when you do that. Well, we have to teach people what happens when you stick a psychedelic into a mind, that it's something to be respected and it's something to be valued for the insights that you can get and for the healing that it can create. And it's not something that you do lightly, but it's also not something that you should have to go to a central government and get permission to do. Mm-hmm. That it's something that people should be able to do with their own doctor or with their own friends. And that that's a more appropriate social mechanism for controlling the power of that tool.
John, thank you so much for being with us today here on Psychedelic Spotlight. Really appreciate your coming.
Thank you.
We've been listening with John Gilmore. He's a member of the MAPS Board of Directors, a builder, a friend of liberty, and I'm Ken Allen. Stay tuned for another Psychedelic Spotlight coming soon, and don't forget to donate at the MAPS website. Support the efforts of the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies at www.maps.org.